Welcome, Alan Stein of Kadima Careers. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mary. Thanks a lot for joining me here.
Okay, super. I have some questions for you about the trajectory of your own career and the founding of Kadima Careers. So it's my understanding that you founded Kadima Careers in 2020 during the pandemic. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that and why you named the company Kadima.
In July of 2020, I was at my in-laws in Connecticut. I think I got rejected for my fourth or fifth role in either recruiting or diversity-related efforts. This one was a director of diversity recruiting for Tableau within Salesforce's division. So I got rejected because they said they liked me, they appreciated my insight and unique perspective, but I don't have the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion background, nor the recruiting background, even though I nailed the interviews and I came up with good ideas and suggestions. And this was probably the fifth time I got rejected for either a DEI or a recruiting or talent acquisition sort of role. I got rejected at Google. I got rejected at Facebook. I think I got rejected multiple times at Google. These were internal when I was trying to move internally from roles in customer success or operations or finance or marketing. And I got rejected multiple times. So that became frustrating for me. Also, during that time, we were all homebound with the pandemic. The George Floyd murder had occurred, which was horrendous. There was lots of talk internally within Salesforce with Mark Benioff, the CEO. They brought out all, well, not all, the few Black leaders within the organization, because there were not that many Black leaders within the organization. Actually, one of the best guests we had was Colin Powell, who was on the board of Salesforce at the time. And he actually spoke to the entire company at a town hall about the George Floyd incident and diversity and challenges in society. So I heard a lot of similar talk back in 2012 when I was at Google, when Trayvon Martin was murdered horrendously there. So a lot of Black leaders at Google, and again, there were not a lot. There were probably two leaders that kept going to every town hall, and they were brought out to talk about what Google is going to do about diversity and inclusion. So I heard it was basically like a repeat of what I heard 7 years ago. And during the pandemic, my wife Melanie was reading the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, by Ibram Kendi. She was reading that book to my children. Every night we'd read books while we were homeridden. My kids would hate it, but it was good for them. And I enjoyed listening to it as well. And Ibram Kendi's book, to paraphrase it a little bit, talks about it's not enough to be, not to be racist, but you really need to be anti-racist. You need to take actions that make a difference. Mm-hmm. So all of that kind of stirred the mix that gave me the idea to focus my next chapter in my life of helping people with their careers. It's something that I was always interested in. I was naturally good at. I got 9 people into Google as referrals, which is unusually a high number of successful referrals to get in. So there's this term called ikigai, the Japanese term for the meaning of life, or the raison d'etre. When you can find something that you're good at, that you like doing, that the world needs, and you can make money at. It's like if you imagine a Venn diagram with 4 circles, mm-hmm. if you can blend all 4 of those circles, you found your ikigai. And my ikigai is basically the ability to accelerate and grow careers. And I really like to level the playing field with people that don't know how the system works and don't have access to the same resources and benefits that I've been privileged or lucky enough or born with or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And I decided that at that point, I am going to focus on accelerating careers. I did not leave Salesforce at the time, but I started a company where I was coaching underrepresented, underestimated, underpaid talent to get jobs at the world's best. I focused first on the world's best tech companies. And now I've since broadened it to help people get jobs at any company where that aligns with their values and their desires.
So speaking about words, why did you pick Kadima?
So I was speaking to David on the porch as we were drinking martinis, and I asked him how to say the word accelerate in Hebrew. And I forget what he said. It was not a name that necessarily resonated with me. But he said, what about the word Kadima? And I love the word Kadima. As a child, I used to play this game called Pro Kadima. I have paddles on my back wall there, up there, up top, those two wood paddles. And I reached out to a trademark attorney and found out if we can trademark the term Kadima and Kadima Careers for business services, and we're able to. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got the name Kadima, which means in Hebrew forward or let's go. And that's how I like to think about people's careers, of always moving forward, always accelerating.
That's perfect for what I believe is your Kadima tagline. You own your career, we accelerate it.
Yep, exactly. Okay. And I'm a big believer of that. Opportunity will not come to you. You need to be on the lookout for opportunity, and you need to make that opportunity happen. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to your career, nobody is going to give as much of a hoot about you and your career as you will. So it's really important, just like you own your life, you should own your career, and you should take a proactive action in terms of determining where you want to go and then figuring out a path to get there with help of others, but own your career.
And speaking of owning your career, you have a very aggressive long-term goal from what I've been told. What is Kadima Careers' goal, overarching mission?
So I'm an avid reader of business books and leadership books. And Jim Collins, who I believe is a professor at Stanford Business School, wrote a book, Good to Great. He's written lots of books. And in that book, he talks about the importance of having a mission for a company, even for an individual. And with that mission, to have specificity to it and some sort of deadline with it. So I was reading that and I was trying to think about what my mission is for Kadima Careers and what we're really trying to do. And I was like, okay, let's start with, we want to accelerate 1 million careers by 2040. So when I created that in 2020, that would mean we would need to accelerate 50,000 careers per year. And we've supported dozens, if not hundreds and thousands of people in terms of giving them advice and guidance and support to help accelerate their career. Another thing that Jim Collins talks about, and also something that I learned at Google, is what a BHAG is. I don't know if you ever heard of the term BHAG, B-H-A-G. Mm-hmm. Big, hairy, audacious goal.
All
it's
right.
Something that's pretty common in the tech landscape. I've heard it a lot at Google, of what's our BHAG? And I thought this would be a good BHAG. And Jim Collins talks about it in the book also. Our big, hairy, audacious goal is to accelerate 1 million careers by 2040. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think that's actually conservative once we get the ball moving on what we're building here at Kadima.
It's great to definitely be that ambitious. And besides besides that big goal and sort of your mission to make companies more diverse and inclusive for real, as opposed to just talking the talk, how else would you say Kadima Careers is different from the many thousands of career coaching businesses out there?
It's a great question, Mary. So if you look on LinkedIn and you look up career coaches, you will find between 134,000 and 137,000 career coaches out there. Depends on what day and where the market's at. So there's a lot out there. What makes us different is that we actually focus on the candidate, and we track and measure our numbers and our results maniacally. So I know for a fact that we can get people great jobs in 3.56 months on average, and they are earning $127,400 more after working with us. So A, we're tracking our metrics and measurement. B, I'm taking a lot of the insights that I've learned about building scalable, effective businesses from my time at Google and Facebook and American Express and Salesforce, of building a program and building an organization that is for scale. So even though a lot of my one-on-one coaching is not scalable because there's only one of me, mm-hmm. a lot of those practices are being deployed in group coaching, in digital courses, and eventually software. So we are building something that is effective and efficient at getting people the results that they want. Also, another difference between us and some other programs is we offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. For any reason, if within 30 days people are not happy with our service and our solutions, they can ask for their money back and they will get 100% of their money back. Very few people do that, but we give people that option. And also what is different is, as a founder, I have been on both sides of the table. I have interviewed probably 1,000 people in my career, including about 500 people at Google. And I understand what the decision-making process is, not only hiring, but also compensation-wise. And on the flip side, I have probably interviewed at close to 1,000 different job opportunities, probably at hundreds of companies. I've worked for 21 companies. I've held 29 jobs. I've probably received at least 2 times as number of offers that I've turned down over the course of time. So I understand how things work on both sides of the table, and it's all the same. There are certain tweaks that certain companies have, like Google has a different process of their interviewing, which is rigorous and methodical, and so does Amazon. And if you look at McKinsey and BCG, they have their methods of interviewing, but outside of a few that do it really well, and I think those companies do it really well, there's a few others. Interviewing and recruiting is ineffective, inefficient, poorly created. And because of that, there are ways that you can influence that and backwards engineer the process. So because of that insight on both sides of the equation, that makes us different as well.
I love that you have the inside scoop, but I also love your big tech background, because really you are tracking your successes and your metrics, and not many other career coaches can really do that. You know, so you're walking the walk, you're not just talking the talk, which I think a lot of other coaches do. So let's dive in a little bit into like the myths about job searching. What do you think are the most sort of common myths, and what should professionals really be doing to own the evolution of their career?
There's so many myths out there. Big one is the resume is a key to you getting a job. There's so many resume writers out there, and there's some good resume writers, and everybody needs a resume or a CV, as they call it in Europe and some other places. Everybody needs a resume, but the resume is not going to make or break you. And so much so that I give my resume template away for free. People can grab it and use it. We have a few different versions out there. Your resume, you just need to be able to communicate clearly, articulately, and assume that the person that's looking at your resume is only looking at it between 6 and 60 seconds, which is what all the data says. And based on my knowledge of looking at about 10,000 resumes in my career, that's probably about right. Sometimes I'll spend a little bit longer on a resume if I'm really interested, but usually within a few seconds, I look at it and I either make a decision, interesting, not interesting, and then move on. So people focus way too much on the resume. You need a resume, but get your resume set up in an objectively perfect manner. So no spelling errors, clear to see, keep it to 2 pages minimum. Ideally send it in a PDF format rather than a Google Doc or a Word format, and get it subjectively good enough and then move on. So that's number one, the focus on the resume. Secondly, a loose tangent to that are the focus on cover letters. Cover letters are a big waste of time outside of if you're applying to a small organization where they're actually not going to get a lot of applicants and they might read your cover letter. But I have looked at, like I said, about 10,000 resumes in my career. And if I've read 20 cover letters, I'd be shocked. And only one time can I even remember where a cover letter convinced me to hire somebody.
I actually have a quick question about that, Alan. Is it possible that an employer might look to the cover letter to see if that applicant did research about the company?
If you are a smaller company, they may look for that. So if you're like applying to Kadima Careers for a job, I would want to understand why someone wants to work at Kadima Careers. It could either be conveyed in a cover letter or an email or some reason. Like when you started working with us, you were able to convey what interests you about Kadima and why Kadima. You weren't just like, I don't even think we had a job when you reached out to us. So I think for like, as long as you convey that, it could be in a cover letter. It could be in your narrative. It could be in your email. That's important, especially for a smaller company. If you're hiring at Google or Pfizer or Goldman Sachs, those companies have such hubris that they just assume that you want to work at that company and they don't really care that you're all that excited about Google. They just assume that everybody wants to work at Google. So the cover letters mean less there. So that's another myth. People tell themselves that I'm not Google material or I'm not Amazon material or I'm not American Express material. And I would say BS, bull dinkies to all of that, because you can become that sort of material. You can learn how to get into those organizations. Job acquisition, and I call it job acquisition, not job search, is a learnable skill. you can mm-hmm. learn how the process works. And what we try to do at Kadima is break it down step by step so anybody can learn how these imperfect decisions are being made about who is going to get paid six-figure, seven-figure salary to rent your services for a year or whatever the time period is that you're working there. So mm-hmm. that's another fallacy, that you're not good enough to get into these companies, because I've been at a lot of these companies and there is a lot of good talent there, but there's a lot of crap that seeps through as well. And I'm not saying that listeners are necessarily crap, but if crap gets in there, anybody can get in there.
Well, I mean, also what I love about your concept of owning your career is kind of stepping into your own power and confidence. There's a lot of subjectivity involved with getting a job and also, you know, networking and who you know, getting referrals to get into a company. I know that that's a big part of the Kadima careers framework for you. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. And it's not about buying referrals. It's not about getting referrals. It's about mm-hmm. earning referrals. And the subtle difference there is you need to build those relationships so that somebody is going to feel comfortable putting in a kind word on your behalf. And not mm-hmm. everyone's going to do that, but there's ways that you can influence that conversation. So referrals are such a critical element to getting jobs. If anybody thinks about the jobs that they've had, they will likely think about a lot of jobs that they've gotten because someone put in a kind word on their behalf, someone mm-hmm. referred them, someone recommended them, maybe nepotism there. In my case alone, 24 out of my 29 jobs have come through a referral. Somebody said, hey, Alan's a decent guy. I think you should speak to him. It does mm-hmm. not mean that I did not need to interview for those jobs afterwards. In a couple of the cases, I didn't need to. In a couple of those 24, two out of those 24 were nepotism. Mm-hmm. Those were pretty easy, if at all. I don't know if I had to I don't think I had to interview for the one with my Aunt Sammy and the one with my dad and his company. I don't think I had to interview there. They just had to know like what hours I could work. That was basically the question. But in most cases, the referral will just get you to the interview, and then you still need to prepare for the interview. And in the mm-hmm. case of Google, I got rejected 5 times from submitting applications for roles that I thought I was a really good fit for. And the 6th time, when someone there who went to Binghamton with me talked to me and found out that I was a decent guy and had a decent background, he mm-hmm. put my name in. All of a sudden, the next day, I was on the call with a recruiter. And a month or two later, after 11 rounds of interviews, and again, it's not like you get the job handed to you. I still had to prepare for those interviews and was not a given. I was able to get hired there. But the only reason I got considered at Google is because my friend Ben, he was not a friend at the time. I met him through another friend. Mm-hmm. Ben talked to me and heard my story over a 30-minute conversation. He's like, yeah, I could see Alan potentially working here. Let's put him in as a referral.
I mean, I love that. Clients that work with you, it's really an investment in their career long term. And I love that you give people really good advice about managing their career proactively. You have a little bit of a rule about keeping things moving forward in terms of a career. Can you talk a little bit about that rule?
Yeah. So I call it the 2-year rule. This is only applies really to people and individuals that are focused on growing their career and growing their compensation. While it sounds like everybody wants to do that, not everybody does. Maybe you're at home caring for your child or sick parents, or maybe you just want to earn a decent income, but you're not really looking to maximize your income. Totally cool. But most people that I work with, I call them ambitious professionals because they're professionals that really have ambition to grow their career and compensation. And if you fall under that moniker of an ambitious professional, you should be thinking about the 2-year rule. Every 2 years, you should be going up in terms of getting promoted or getting increased scope, in terms of getting functional or regional or some other sort of experience that grows your career. And if mm-hmm. you're not getting that internally where you're at, then get the hell out. And you should mm-hmm. be looking externally. I suggest people always look externally and always be looking. ABL, always be looking. And think about your career in 2-year increments. And the 2 years was not just pulled out of thin air. When I was at American Express, they gave me training as a new manager of how critical it was as a manager to keep my direct reports engaged and interested in the role. because from the company's perspective, the first 6 to 12 months, that individual is learning the ropes and not necessarily providing value to the company. And then after the 6 months or so, then that employee provides more value to the role and the company. And the longer that you can keep that employee happy, content in that role, the more value that that individual is providing to the team and the company. Well, I flip that on the side. From my perspective as an individual, the first 6 months, I'm learning tremendous amount. I'm learning new information. I'm meeting new people. After the 6 months, I'm kind of plateauing a little bit. And then after 12 or 18 months or so, I'm not learning anything new. And if they're not paying me more or giving me more responsibility or giving me something to grow my career, I'm getting exploited by the company and my value is getting exploited by the company.
That's really insightful, Alan, because even if an individual is at a point in their career and their life where they don't want a really high stress, growth-oriented job for themselves, they have to always be, you know, working on the people that are reporting to them in terms of helping them to grow their career. So that's really important. You know, if somebody has to sort of take a step back because they have kids or grandkids that they're taking care of or sick parents, that they should keep their eye on, you know, the people reporting to them and their career development. I like that. So actually, this is kind of a big question now because of the cost of education, but also inflation and our challenging economic times. I meet a lot of young people who are like, you went to Columbia Business School, Mary. What do you think? Is it really worth it to MBA now or not to MBA now?
I'd be curious if you remember how much your MBA cost. Mine cost $138,000. I don't know if you remember how much yours set you back.
I remember tuition. This wasn't living expenses. Tuition was $7,500 per semester.
Right. So for four semesters, it would be $30,000.
Yeah. And then my living expenses on top of that.
So I remember the 138 because that was a savings that I had built up that I had to draw down on to pay my tuition and my living expenses and all that stuff. I fundamentally believe that the top MBA programs are valuable. There's the M7, the Magnificent Seven, so-called by themselves. It's Columbia. It's Northwestern, it's Chicago, it's Wharton, it's Stanford, it's Harvard, and MIT. Mm-hmm. There are other good schools that you could argue that are equally valuable, like NYU and INSEAD and Tuck and Duke. And you can argue like UT, you can argue at the cusp which other programs are really worth the money. But then there are a ton of second tier, third tier programs that might be at a good school. Like I just met someone on LinkedIn, nothing against a Brandeis MBA, but he's the first person I ever heard of that was going for an MBA at Brandeis, and Brandeis is a good undergrad school. Mm-hmm. I really question, I don't know what the cost is of a Brandeis MBA. I question if that's worth his time and money to go to Brandeis for his MBA.
Is their Brandeis MBA program new or has it always been around?
I have no idea. I have no idea. This guy just connected with me on LinkedIn and he had something on his profile that said he was at the Brandeis MBA program. It's named after someone. I don't know. But all these schools have MBA programs, Wake Forest and Illinois and like Ohio State, all these good schools, Florida State, all these good schools have MBA programs. Mm-hmm. And these schools are good schools, good name brand schools. But is the MBA really worth the value there? I'm not sure. I tend to think not, but that's open to debate because those MBA programs at some of those second or third tier MBA schools, I don't think they cost $250,000. And that's what a Columbia MBA costs now. I think 240 or 250, maybe up to 280. And a Wharton one does as well, somewhere in 230, 240K range. If you're spending $75,000 for a University of Miami, I don't think that's worth it. If you're getting paid if your employer's paying for it or you get a scholarship, yeah, then maybe you can learn some stuff and you get the MBA on there. But if you're paying out of your pocket and you're giving up some earning years, because usually if you're going there full time, you can't be working. And it's different if it's a part-time MBA.
I agree.
I would question seriously if an MBA is the only way to get to where you're headed.
My dad continued to work at a corporate insurance company, and they paid for it, and he got his MBA at NYU. Yeah. This is many, many, many years ago. Yeah. For me, the value of it, you know, I didn't pursue an investment banking career. You know, I pursued a career in marketing and PR, but the real value of it is the referral network, you know, networking. You know, when I call somebody that I went to college with, or I went to Columbia with, or reach out to them via LinkedIn or whatever, they're much more likely to engage with me because we're part of the same club. And I'm sure you agree with me on that as well. That's truly valuable in terms of managing your career long term.
Yeah. So you want to join a club where those club members are at the organizations and places where you want to be.
In terms of Kadima's focus on earning referrals, which I love, not just asking for referrals willy-nilly. I know that LinkedIn, you're very, very engaged on LinkedIn, but you're also a big proponent of people using it for their job search and to manage their career. So can you talk a little bit about that and then also touch upon the wonderful opening world, new world of ChatGPT in the job search?
Yeah, so those are two different amazing tools that are both helpful in different ways. I was fortunate to learn about LinkedIn very early on. This is one of the many pieces of valuable things I got out of my $138,000 MBA at Columbia. I was in a class, I think it was stats or decision modeling. I forget which class it was, but the professor told us about this new social network that he was likening it to Orkut at the time, which was a big social network that was big in Brazil. And I think MySpace, and maybe Friendster at the time, because I don't even think Facebook was around in 2004 or barely. And he was advising a student to get onto LinkedIn. He's like, hey, this is going, like he was talking about the network effect of businesses and saying, this is going to really change the way that people can network and build relationships. So I joined that day on April 1st, 2004. And I've been on LinkedIn longer than 99.53% of people. And I wasn't a total user and fan of LinkedIn right then in business school, because a lot of people were not on it then. But the power of any social network or professional network grows with the number of people and the engagement on that community. And now I don't know how many people LinkedIn had back then. I think I was member 450,000 or so. And now there are 930 million people on LinkedIn. So everybody that I want to find at almost every company, especially when I was looking to be hired, almost every hiring manager is on LinkedIn. They may not be active on LinkedIn, but almost everybody has a profile on LinkedIn. And the way I generally advise people to use LinkedIn is as a proactive tool. Identify where you want to go, figure out who is at those companies or those organizations, and build relationships with them. Do not ask for a referral. Do not ask for something transactional, but build relationships. So start having a conversation. It's kind of like if you're DMing someone on Twitter or something like that, or tweeting at someone on Twitter, you're building that relationship. And then ultimately, ideally getting it offline or off of LinkedIn, so you can have a video chat or an in-person chat with the individual, learn about them, how they got there, and build those relationships. Some of those will turn into potential referrals. Some of them won't. And I always advise people, do not ask for referrals. And the reason why I say do not ask for referrals is almost everybody will say yes to your face, and less than half of them will actually follow up. Mm-hmm. And with the ask, they'll say yes to your face just to shut you up. And it's easier for people to say yes than no. But when push comes to shove, if you need someone to put in a referral for you at Microsoft or at UPS or at whatever company you're applying for, unless they volunteered and said, hey, Mary, you seem like you have a nice background. I've enjoyed this conversation. If there's anything I can ever do, if you're ever looking for a role here at SAP, let me know and I'd be happy to put you in as a referral. That's what I call as an earned referral. That person is more likely going to follow through on that rather than someone that is going to say yes to you just to shut you off.
Yeah, people want to get to know you. You know, just like when we first chatted, your mission at Kadima aligned with me, you know, my personality, my goals, what I think about the world, wanting to quote unquote fix the world. I just love what Kadima's doing. And I think it's really important. It's really impactful. It's needed now more than ever because the demographics of our whole country are radically changing very, very quickly. And, you know, the percentages of people that are underrepresented have to really go up. And it's completely advantageous to companies to do that from a competitive standpoint as well, you know, and not just to have tokens in their organizations, but to have truly diverse teams that can problem solve for their customers.
There's so many reasons. There's academic research, there's anecdotal research, diversity of thought, diversity of backgrounds, diversity of experience just leads to better decisions and better outcomes.
Yes, the research is definitely incredibly compelling. So actually, that's a good segue into what you think about the challenges in terms of leadership today, maybe what you learned from your corporate career, primarily in big tech, but now you've really pivoted to the other side, just like you've done recruiting on both sides. You've been an applicant and you've recruited on the inside. Touch upon your thoughts about the challenges of leadership, both in a big corporate environment and as an entrepreneur.
Well, it depends on whose challenge or whose perspective the challenge is coming from. So from leader's perspective, I don't know how much of a challenge they have. Leaders are in charge. They are given some hierarchical power to wield in whatever way they so choose, and depends on the organization and depends on how much mandate or accountability that organization holds that leader to. So when you are assigned a leadership role or given a leadership role, you can do whatever the hell you want with it, unless there are ramifications, either positive ramifications and reward for good work or negative ramification and punishment for bad work. So I have seen leaders that are quite good in terms of inspiring and motivating and getting more out of their teams. I've seen leaders that are quite poor in terms of creating a psychologically unsafe environment, an environment that does not welcome or engender difference of opinion, that's very top-down in nature. And from the leader's perspective, I've seen some of those leaders succeed on both sides of that equation because they are either supported or punished for acts that they do or do not do. So the challenge, I don't think, is leadership. I think the challenge is more as you as an individual who's being led, that you may have different expectations of what a leader should be. And there is no book. Well, there are thousands or hundreds of thousands of books on leadership, and some of them are great. Most of them are at least good. But some of them are fantastic, and there are some very good strategies and philosophies on how to lead effectively, whether it's to be like a servant leader, or like Adam Grant writes a lot of good things on how to be an effective leader. I think Google actually did the best job in terms of giving the blueprint of what it means to be a good manager. They have 10 attributes that they track and measure people on, and it's like, are you a good coach? Do you care personally about your team? Are you setting a clear vision? Do you have the technical or subject matter expertise to help lead the team? There's a series of questions, like how open are you to outside opinion and thought? So I don't think leadership is challenged. I think we as individuals that are being led are challenged because you are not going to have the same leadership experience that I have. You're going to run into crappy leaders. You're going to run into some great leaders. And it really depends on what that leader is getting incented on. And everything goes back to incentives. What is the incentive for that leader to do something good or to do something not so good? If all they need to do is kiss up and they can kick down as much as they want, they may choose to do that. And in most organizations, you can do that. As long as you manage up really well, it doesn't matter so much what you do in terms of managing down.
Actually, I think you have a little bit of a story about leadership or being a manager at Google.
I joined Google in May of 2011, and very quickly thereafter, Google would do a survey called the Manager Feedback Survey. They've also called it the Upward Feedback Survey. I forget, they changed the name at some point, but either Manager Feedback Survey or Upward Feedback Survey. They do that on 6-month increments. And my first Manager Feedback Survey came back really piss poor. I was in the bottom 25th percentile. I don't think I received anything positive, except I think people thought I cared about them So that was a positive. Mm-hmm. But in terms of setting a vision, in clearly communicating with the team, in terms of prioritization and a few other dimensions, my score was really terrible. I don't know how terrible it was, but I know it was in the bottom 25th percentile, because Google would put you in bottom 25th percent, the mid 50 percentile, or the top 25th percentile. They didn't give you the specifics at that time. I think they've since changed it. So I knew I was in the bottom 25th percentile. I did not know it at the time. I thought all managers received this, but I was given basically manager intervention, but they call it NMI, new manager integration. I thought all managers got this that were new at Google, but it was only reserved for managers that were troubled. And I was deemed as a troubled manager. So they brought HR in and they did big focus groups with my team. And they're like, what the hell's going on with Alan here? So my team, I'm very thankful to them. They sat down with the HR VP, the HR business partner, and gave feedback. They gave some very tough feedback to me on what I was doing wrong. I was able to internalize that and then act upon it. And some of the stuff was really serious stuff, not serious, but that I would tell four different people to do the same thing. So people lost trust in what I was telling them to do because I was asking four different people. And some of the stuff was kind of more trivial, like stop having people use Excel instead of Google Sheets, which I think you would find funny because I know you like Excel and not Google Sheets. Back in 2011, Google Sheets sucked. Excel was so much better. And I was using Excel, but we were a Google shop. So anyway, I was getting feedback from my team to stop working in Excel. I needed to use Google Sheets. So that was easily correctable. Anyway, over the course of every 6-month period, my score got progressively better to the point in 2015 that I was nominated and I received the award as a Google Great Manager. And this was an award that was quite prestigious and only 20 to 25 people across the organization win it. Mm-hmm. And it was based on nominations from my team, based on nominations from my peers, and based on nomination from my leadership and support from leadership. So I actually won one of the Google Great Manager Awards. I have like something in the back here, a little tchotchke from there. And they flew me and my wife and the other 24 other Google Great Managers down to Cabo, which was one of the coolest trips I've ever taken. And they brought some senior leaders down there and we did some leadership development and some fun stuff, go-karting and or ATVing and tequila tasting and things like that as well. And it was one of the best experiences, but it taught me that leadership, management, job acquisition, almost everything in life is learnable.
Yes.
If you seek the feedback, I wasn't seeking the feedback. Google just gave it to me. But if you pay attention to the feedback, you try to internalize the feedback and you have the support as well. And I had the support of Google's HR and my manager wanted to intervene here and help support me. And I also had the mindset of, hey, I want to improve here because I don't like getting these really crappy scores. You can improve as a manager. And I firmly believe that. And yeah, so I went from one of the worst managers at Google to one of the best. And then this is a longer story. I don't think we have time for it now. Then 6 months later, I got fired, but not because I was a great manager, but that fact that I was a great manager played into very little play into my value or to Google, because they just were able to toss that aside when they decided to get rid of me because of actions I took and mistakes that I made. But even having that great manager award did not save me from a mess up that I did and I admitted to, even though I apologized for. It did not save my butt at the end of the day.
But you were very smart. I would imagine some of the challenges you had with your initial lower scores were simply not having a lot of experience managing people in previous jobs. But you also seized the opportunity and, you know, you weren't defensive with your boss and HR. And you seized the opportunity to learn those skills, and they're standing you in great stead now as an entrepreneur and a founder at Kadima Careers for sure.
I'm very open to feedback. I will not always address the feedback given to me, but I will always listen to it.
Of course.
And there was probably some feedback that was given to me in that survey, the first survey. I don't recall off the top of my head. There's probably some that I did not agree with and that I did not take, but I read it all and I made a conscious decision of what am I going to take and what do I disagree with? And is there a reason why I disagree? And also what was important is I thanked my team for the feedback. I shared it out with the team and I told my team, hold me accountable for doing this. And if I send you another spreadsheet in Excel, call me on that. Mm-hmm. And if I'm like assigning people multiple things, I'm going to try not to do that. Call me on that real time.
Yeah, I think that those two things are really important. Being open to the feedback, whether you take it or not, but also whoever's in your life professionally or personally, kind of making them your accountability partner. You know, I really like that because that's really how people move the needle in terms of their own professional and personal development. Saying, you know, let me know when I'm promising to do this, but let me know when I fall short because I might forget or whatever. So that's a great story. I love that Google story. Alan, if you want to share any last little thought for job searchers.
I think the last piece of feedback is own your career. Like as we like started with, no one is going to care about your career. No one cares about where you are heading more than you do. Mm-hmm. Maybe your parents will, maybe your spouse or your partner will, but even there, you can't count on that. And like, I do have lots of people that care for me. I'm very fortunate like that, but ultimately it is you who own the decisions that you make. I know that not everybody is afforded the same playing, is playing on the same playing field. So as a white dude born in America in the 1970s, I had a very different outcome than if I was born in the 1930s in Germany. I'm Jewish, of Jewish descent. Mm-hmm. I would have had a very different background. And if you ever read Viktor Frankl's book, I think it's called The Meaning of Life, I would not have been as strong as Viktor Frankl was to survive the Nazi concentration camps like he did with the mindset that he did. So I think it's very important that people need to own their career. I think it's also very important to call out the point that my perspective is different than your perspective. We have very different learning experiences and situations with that, but it's really important to understand what you can control, what you can influence, and be clear about the very large swath of life that you have no control over. Mm-hmm. And don't focus on that. There's nothing you can do about it. But the stuff you can control and influence, own it.
Always stay on that career driver's seat.
Yep. That's why we call the Sick Career Podcast, Steer Your Career with Kadima. hold the steering wheel and take control.
Okay. Thank you so much, Alan. Have a great one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
The newsletter rocks. Check out the accelerator, XLR8R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You'll get the occasional pet picture. And you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You are going to love the next one.